In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, analysis of international, mostly international political news from political scientists with foreign policy expertise, namely Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Happy to be here.
Wayne Moyer, happy to have you as well, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Wayne, welcome.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Ben. It's good to be here.
All right. So much. We'll see how much we get through later in the hour. We want to talk about the role of Congress when it comes to foreign policy under this new president. Also, Biden's first sanctions against the Russian government and our southern border preventing out-of-control migration from Central America, a challenge for the president. And perhaps we'll get to this. Perhaps you saw this story. You may need a vaccine passport to travel abroad in the future. The Israelis are starting off with that. But first, let's talk about domestic terrorism and some news here out of Iowa. And I'll just read from the Associated Press this morning to get into this topic. The discovery of a live pipe bomb at a central Iowa polling place as voters were casting ballots in a special election forced an evacuation of the building. According to police, officers called to the Lakeside Center in Ankeny around 9:30 yesterday found a device that looked like a pipe bomb in the grass near the center. Police later confirmed that the device was a pipe bomb. Now, this banquet hall was being used as a polling place for the Ankeny School District special election. Police evacuated the building. A little bit later on in this report, it says the investigation is going on. A tie right to Iowa to possible domestic terrorism. Of course, this week, the FBI Director Christopher Wray appeared on Capitol Hill for his first public testimony since the insurrection on the Capitol in January. His testimony, in it, Wray pointed to several other violent attacks in recent years, suggesting that January 6th didn't stand alone.
The problem of domestic terrorism has been metastasizing across the country for a long time now, and it's not going away anytime soon.
Okay. Wray also said the FBI currently has around 2,000 domestic terrorism cases open. He said that's double the number from when he became FBI director almost 4 years ago. He said the number of white supremacist arrests has tripled over that time span, and the number of anarchist arrests is also up significantly. Wayne, let me go to you first of all. Before we get to our international analysis, comment on Christopher Ferre's revelations, I guess, to many news listeners and watchers, revelations that domestic terrorism is a much bigger threat these days than foreign terrorism.
Well, I think that's an argument now of which we have considerable documentation, it's good that the FBI is focused on it. The problem would be if they had not focused on it. It's hard at this stage to make any connection between that and what's happened in Ankeny, though there's a correlation. But what happened in Ankeny will require, I think, considerable investigation before we can draw conclusions as to who's behind it or what the reasons were.
Right. Good point to emphasize there, Wayne. We don't want to be alarmist here. Jim, your view on this point before we move on.
Well, I was really stunned to see this. Iowa is really known for its sort of clean politics and clean political processes. And to sort of hear about this, a pipe bomb over a special election for apparently the use of funding by the Ankeny School District is really quite stunning. I mean, we can only speculate, but maybe this is some kind of personal issue that somebody has over this. But I, I truly believe, or I hope, that this is not a trend within Iowa. I mean, Iowa really is one of these, often characterized as one of these moral states, one of these states that's not taken up by any kind of corruption or any kind of activity like this.
Right, and but the fact that Christopher Wray said 2,000 domestic terrorism cases open, double the number when he became FBI director just 4 years ago, number of white supremacist arrests tripling over that span time. Jim, the larger picture, worrying not just for Iowa, for the whole U.S., this trend.
It really is. It's very troubling when they say, when Christopher Wray says that this is a bigger threat domestically than internationally, given the kind of experience that the United States has had with international terrorism. So clearly this is an area that's got to be addressed, and certainly it's going to be addressed by the FBI, but I suspect that, you know, local agencies will also hopefully they already are acting on these kind of threats.
Jim and Wayne, we have you here this hour mainly for your foreign policy expertise. We love to have you as a duo to look at what's been happening, and we are now about six weeks into the Biden presidency, a whole different approach to foreign policy. Foreign policy often described as Biden's first love. He's, of course, former chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, known for respecting Congress's role in shaping U.S. foreign policy. Looking back over the six weeks in office, his administration has given the order to bomb Syria, sanctioned Saudi Arabia and Myanmar, taken steps to reenter the Iran nuclear deal. And last week, Biden drawing some criticism, even from his own party, after ordering those airstrikes on the Iran-backed militia groups in Syria without first seeking congressional approval, and also for refusing to impose penalties on the Saudi crown prince, whom the Biden administration publicly blamed for the brutal 2018 murder of that journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Wayne, when you ever have a new president in office, we can look at recent presidents and see how they work with Congress, the degree which they consult with Congress over actions that are done outside the U.S. How has the Congress been reacting to these first few weeks of the Biden foreign policy?
Well, certainly the Democrats are quite active in insisting that they be consulted. And I think that's true of the Republicans as well. I think both Barack Obama and Donald Trump were hesitant to consult with Congress. They tended to take decisions in the White House and let Congress know what they had done after they had made decisions. Biden's, I think, in a different situation. One, he is a creature of Congress. Two, he's got a 50-50 Congress. He needs congressional support. And three, Trump had Congress in fear. A Twitter statement could ruin a career. Biden is not in that kind of position so that he can intimidate congressmen and congresswomen the same way that Trump did.
Mm-hmm. Jim, your view on how Biden compares with other recent presidents, George W. Bush, Obama, Trump, in this era?
Well, I think I have a little bit different take on this. You know, under the War Powers Resolution, the president, it says very directly in that piece of legislation that the president shall consult in every possible instance with Congress before deploying American forces here. And, you know, I think probably President Biden is really following the same example of other presidents, informing the Congress largely after the fact. I went and looked at the report that the President Biden sent to Congress after this latest attack. And it's very interesting. It's very much like all of the other, actually about 200 plus reports that have been sent to the Congress for presidential use of force abroad. And the president says he's not really complying with the War Powers Resolution. He says, I'm providing this report as part of my effort to keep the Congress fully informed, consistent with, but not in compliance with, consistent with the War Powers Resolution. So even though, you know, Biden has been a creature of Congress, I think that presidents, once they get into that office, really kind of guard their prerogatives when they want to use force or not. And in the same report, President Biden said, you know, the justification for using force was my inherent powers under Article 2 of the Constitution and my right under the UN Charter, Article 51, to engage in self-defense. So I think there's going to be more of this kind of back and forth with Congress, whether, you know, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Menendez, reacted, you know, sort of strongly about not being informed, and Senator Kaine, you know, saying, why weren't we informed? I think there'll be more pushback by Congress than there had been with President Trump. I think, Wayne's right in the sense that, you know, members were kind of frightened of any kind of tweet that might wreck their political future here. So there'll be more pushback, but I'm not sure that there's going to be more of this kind of consultation.
For your analysis, let's listen to the voice of President Biden on this sort of virtual meeting with the Mexican president, expressing his interest in working with Mexico at the outset of
The United States and Mexico are stronger when we stand together. There's a long and complicated history between our nations that haven't always been perfect neighbors with one another, but we have seen over and over again the power and the purpose when we cooperate, and we're safer when we work together, whether it's addressing the challenges of our shared border or getting this pandemic under control.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Joe Biden looking to undo his predecessor's hard lines on immigration policies. How to do that while at the same time prevent another cycle of out-of-control migration from Central America? Wayne, your thoughts, first of all.
Well, it's going to be tricky because there are going to be a lot of pressures on the border. But Biden has to show that he's a little more humane in terms of his treatment of refugees than was Trump. He's letting a few more people in the country, but on the other hand, he's turning most of them back. He has the problem of unaccompanied children, which he will have to find hosts for. He's in a political dilemma. The Republicans are waiting to pounce on him for this issue. On one hand, he's got to be tough enough to stop the immigration from coming in. On the other hand, he has to show that he's a little more open, a little more tolerant, a little more humane in treating with the immigrants than Trump was.
Okay. We're having some technical difficulties. That's why I'm on the phone right now. Jim, your view on this? Sorry to be distracted a bit.
Well, I think, you know, Wayne's analysis is really much what I would agree with in terms of what the Biden administration is trying to do. I mean, certainly there was a campaign commitment, I wouldn't say he used a language just opening up the border, but to be more humane in terms of the kind of immigration policy here. I think what is happening, certainly this fits in other areas, that once you get into office, you find that, you know, trying to really fulfill really rapidly the campaign promise that you have made is a little more difficult. And I'm just wondering, as you think back on this, and there's obviously been some rush, at least the Border Patrol people have said that there's been an increase in numbers. Was there really an effort to try to do too much too quickly here? You know, I know the Homeland Security Secretary has said that there's, you know, not a crisis, but I noted that one of the members of Congress from Texas, from the border region, actually said, and a Democrat said that, you know, and a crisis is ensuing. So I think probably there has to be probably a little bit of a pullback in terms of how quickly they want to really make these kind of changes. Because if, you know, if and in fact it explodes, there will be no effort, which is a longer-term goal of the Biden administration, to get congressional reform on immigration policy and to get a pathway to citizenship. So I think there has to be probably in the short term some pullback. Now, I did note in some of the analyses that have been done about what's going on is that actually the Border Patrol has been returning some of the people that are trying to enter to Mexico. So it's really a difficult situation. On the one hand, to try to maximize the kind of humane response that certainly the Biden administration wants to reflect, and the practicality of trying to both house the children and also have a pathway for asylum seekers to actually have their hearing and to have a chance to stay in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish up this half hour with a little bit of discussion of Russia, because yesterday the Biden administration declassified an intelligence finding that one of Russia's leading intelligence agencies orchestrated the poisoning of the opposition leader Alexei Navalny and announced its first sanctions against the Russian government for the attack and his imprisonment. These sanctions are closely mirroring a series of actions that European nations and Britain took all back in October and expanded on Monday. The sanctions are notable chiefly because they are the first that Joe Biden has taken in his 6 weeks as since becoming president. So to you, Wayne, this is a show of unity with the Europeans, mainly returning to work more in concert with our European allies and dealing with Putin. Is that the way you see it, Wayne?
It certainly is. I think that's a very important element of it. Also, there's a change from Trump's policies as well. Trump didn't express any support for Navalny at all, and tried to keep from any kind of real tensions with Russia. And Biden obviously doesn't feel the same kind of link to Putin that I think that Trump felt. But I think the European element is really critically important.
Mm-hmm. Just as Jim, your view on Russia and how the Biden administration is really taking a much different tact here.
Yes, I think that's right. Certainly, and so quickly in the administration, you know, unlike other earlier administrations that there was really an effort to kind of at least an attempt to reset relations. There really is putting down a marker here by the Biden administration in terms of what they expect out of Russia and what kind of actions that they will take. I think we have to be a little bit sanguine about whether these sanctions will do very much. I mean, they're largely symbolic in nature. And I think it's interesting to note that even though, and in my own view, that it's hard for me to believe that Putin didn't know about this poisoning episode, just like MBS didn't know about the killings of the journalist here, Khashoggi here, that neither set of sanctions were really directed at the principal, if you will, and I think this, you know, it's understandable. Because there's kind of strategic considerations of both dealing with Russia, whether it's on nuclear weapons or on other issues, as well as dealing with Saudi Arabia on some Middle East issues here. So the sanctions went sort of right to the doorstep, if you will, of the leader, but not really incorporating the leader. I think that's an interesting kind of parallel here that we see in the sanctions that were announced. Right. I think the other refreshing thing about the Biden administration is they actually released the intelligence. They declassified the intelligence reports for both of these instances, for for both with regard to Russia and with regard to Saudi Arabia here.
Okay, and we will talk more after our break. We've got a couple minutes before the break, but more in depth about Saudi Arabia, also Iran, the perhaps we'll see. I'll ask you about whether we could have a resurrection of the Iran nuclear deal. But Wayne, what about this point that there would have been, I mean, in both cases, in Russia and in the case of Saudi Arabia, these sanctions stopped short of sanctioning the top leadership, the senior leadership in Saudi Arabia, as well as in Russia, Putin?
I very much agree with what Jim is saying on this. Foreign policy always has to balance different interests. And there are some reasons why we need to work with both Russia and with Saudi Arabia. And to the extent that you sanction the leaders, you are going to have to make some sacrifices in some other policy areas. And Putin is controlling Russia. And to the extent that we antagonize him, that may lead to new weapons developments on the Russians' parts, which then we'll have to respond to. In the case of Saudi Arabia, the more we antagonize Mohammed bin Salman, that has implications in terms of Saudi investments in the United States. It has implications in terms of intelligence cooperation with the United States. It has implications in terms of overall Middle East stability, of which Saudi Arabia is a major player.
Okay. We'll be back after a short break with our guests for this Politics Wednesday. Wayne Moyer, you just heard there, of Grinnell College, and Jim McCormick, professor of political science as well at ISU, Iowa State University in Ames. When we come back, we'll dig more into the Middle East. We'll talk about Iran, President Joe Biden's first weeks of handling Iran and Saudi Arabia. As a candidate, Biden promised a swift return to the Iran nuclear deal. We'll talk about that when we return. Also, their comment on the protests in Hong Kong and Myanmar. We would like to touch on that as well. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. A look at international politics with Wayne Moyer and Jim McCormick. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break.
If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, are political scientists with many years of foreign policy expertise. And in just a moment, I want to return to the Middle East. But before that, one of our listeners, Greg, is joining us from Waterloo. Earlier in the hour, if you were with us, you noticed that we were talking about domestic terrorism. We don't know if the discovery of a live pipe bomb at a central Iowa polling place yesterday, where voters were casting ballots in a special election, is domestic terrorism. It is under investigation, but we do know that domestic terrorism, especially white supremacist terrorism, is up across the country, according to testimony by the FBI Director Christopher Wray. Let's go to Greg in Waterloo. I think your question ties into this, Greg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. First off, I'm a Democrat, because what I say is supposedly might be helpful for the Republicans. I feel that the Republicans, by sticking with Trump and agreeing to the election, that there was election fraud, is joining with the alt-right. Karl Rove mentioned in his talks with Trump that he would avoid the alt-right. And Trump has welcomed them, and it's a implicit, complicit, grassly And the Republicans are accepting the alt-right. I think that's dangerous for the Republicans. Plus, I think it's really dangerous for the country.
Greg in Waterloo, let's Jim comment on Greg's observation there.
Yeah, I think he's really right that if there's too much embrace by the Trump and its supporters of the alt-right, or any embrace, I should say, that's going to hurt their chances. I mean, because it turns the any kind of, if they want to seek election on the basis of issues, it gets blinded by this kind of attack that's kind of a non sequitur to the issues that are at hand. So I think the caller really is offering some good advice, I suppose, to all political parties, but to the in terms of getting tied up with fringe groups here, but particularly in this case, to the Republicans.
Okay. Let's move back to our focus on foreign policy, back to the Middle East, where we were before the break. Thanks for that call, Greg, in Waterloo. President Biden's first weeks of handling Iran and Saudi Arabia, look at that. As a Democratic candidate, it's worth remembering Biden promised a swift return to the Iran nuclear deal. He then aimed to leverage that negotiation to curb other aspects of Tehran's aggressive behavior, like its growing ballistic missile program. On the campaign trail, Biden called Saudi Arabia a pariah state. He vowed to make it, quote, pay the price for human rights violations, including that murder of the dissident journalist. On Friday, though, Biden released unclassified intelligence report directly blaming the Saudi crown prince for the killing of that journalist. However, Biden declined to punish the nation's de facto ruler outright. Let's listen to a little bit of State Department spokesperson Ned Price telling reporters on Monday, quote, our relationship with Saudi Arabia is very important.
From the start, this administration sent a frank message to Saudi leaders. We seek a partnership that reflects our important work together and our shared interests and priorities, but also one conducted with greater transparency, responsibility, and accord with America's values. In reestablishing U.S. expectations for our relationship with Saudi Arabia, our intent is to make this partnership, which already spans some 80 years, even more sustainable going forward.
Wayne, perhaps you can help us understand, remind us of why Saudi Arabia is such an important ally to U.S. interests in that area.
Well, I think there's several reasons. Even though we ourselves are less dependent on oil from Saudi Arabia than we used to be, our allies in Europe are highly dependent on it still. There also is the issue of a counter to Iran, a country in the Middle East that would counter the growth of Iranian influence. Saudi Arabia clearly plays a major role. Saudi Arabia invests a lot in the United States. The Saudi Arabian military is totally dependent on the United States, so a great deal of our military sales, whether you like them or not, go to Saudi Arabia, which leads to profits for American businesses. So there are a lot of reasons that we would not want to completely break relations with Saudi Arabia. But mm-hmm. There are also reasons why we need to draw red lines, and I think Biden is trying to draw one.
Mm-hmm. Drawing that line, Jim, is the difficulty. We had on Saturday Iran condemning those U.S. airstrikes against the Iran-backed militias in Syria. And then it denied, though, responsibility for those attacks on U.S. targets in Iraq that prompted Friday's strike. So when we talk about Iran and Saudi Arabia, we have to include what's going on in these other nation states, Syria, in Iraq as well, don't we? It's very complicated.
Well, yes, and it really is reflective, I think, in part of this kind of Sunni-Shia rivalry for sort of a control, operating control among the Arabs states in the region here. And that's where you get, you know, Iran is involved with Iraq. I noticed that there was just a meeting of the foreign minister of Iran and Iraq you know, sort of pledging their friendship with one another and so on, and cooperation. And of course, there's Syria, which is getting assistance from Iran. But there's another player here in Syria, of course, and that is Russia. So it is Iran and Iraq and Syria and Saudi Arabia, as well as this outside forces of Russian involvement here. So it is the complexity of it really makes it important for the United States to have, you know, some influence there in terms of the possible outcome. Certainly, we have as our interest that Iran will not become the dominant player in the region, nor, although I think we've ceded probably Russia influence with regard to Syria. I think there's one other question here, and that's, of course, Israel. We haven't even mentioned it. Mm-hmm. You know, Iran is a great threat to Israel, you know, in terms of their calling for the destruction of Israel and so on. And the interesting thing about Saudi Arabia is I think there's a kind of a quiet kind of cooperation between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which also the United States would not want to excise entirely in the region.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jim McCormick, Wayne Moyer, our guests, political scientists on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. If you've just tuned in, let's move on to, well, Asia, Southeast Asia, and to Hong Kong. There's been news out of there. Of course, Hong Kong, a special administrative region of China. When Jim and Wayne and I were younger men, it was part of the Commonwealth of Britain, right? We have to remind ourselves of that.
Thank you very much.
Well, I included myself in there with you, Jim. It's been a few decades. On Monday, hundreds of people assembled outside a court in Hong Kong in a rare act of protest after 47 of the city's most prominent pro-democracy politicians and activists were arrested. Inside the court, those opposition figures arraigned on charges of conspiracy to commit subversion. Such demonstrations have become an unusual sight in Hong Kong in the past year, as Beijing has imposed some harsh national security laws and restrictions there. Jim, take this one, first of all, to you on this one. How do you see the current situation in Hong Kong? What remains of Hong Kong's special status, independence from mainland China?
Well, I think it's really a sad case here that democracy or any kind of hope for democracy or the continuance even of the 50-year agreement in Hong Kong seems like very much increasingly a dead letter here. You know, the argument that only those candidates that are so-called patriots can run in any of these elections here, or now they're even extending it to the judiciary to make sure that the judiciary is composed of patriots. It really looks like much more direct rule from Beijing. And so I think the future of Hong Kong, as vibrant a city as it is and an important sort of crossroads within Asia, I think is really going to be something of the past, and only our memories here, Ben, of when Hong Kong was a free and operating really colony of Britain, I guess, but certainly with a lot of home rule here. I think it will be a distant memory in not too many years, even though it's supposed to go have this 50-year until 47, if my math is right, that it was supposed to be the special administrative region where there would be, this two systems, one country idea.
Right. And also a dim view of the future of the political opposition from you, Wayne, in Hong Kong. Not a great outlook.
I agree with Jim. I'd add a couple of things. This is going to hurt China economically. Hong Kong is a very important business center for investing money in China, and it's not going to be easy to replace it. And a question in my mind is why President Xi Jinping is doing it now. And my best guess is that he's looking for some kind of victory. The economy hasn't done very well. He's had to deal with the pandemic. He's extended his term as president for life. How does he continue to justify his regime? And the best I can come up with is that gaining full control over Hong Kong may be the way to do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to a different spot in Asia. On Sunday, the authorities in the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar, formerly Burma, began their most violent crackdown to date on protesters who have been massing in the streets for weeks in opposition to a military coup that happened February 1st. This is violence against unarmed, mostly peaceful protesters. I guess in the most recent bout, leaving 18 dead, more than 30 wounded, according to the UN Human Rights Office. Also, these crackdowns taking place across the country. Jim, this is a loss of a fledgling new democracy in the world before our eyes.
Well, it is that. But, you know, I think the longer term view here is, of course, that Myanmar or Burma previously was always sort of dominated by the military, and they're coming back into full sway here. It'll be interesting to see, and apparently, at least at this juncture, that the ASEAN effort, the Association of Southeast Asian Nation efforts to try to sort of intervene or to serve as a mediating role seems to have had little effect here. And they're going forward with, I think they're going forward with the trial for Sheesh, you'll help me with the name here, on her name here. The former leader here. And so that's going to be, I think, another kind of flashpoint here.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, to you on with a few of your thoughts on Myanmar.
Well, the first thing is just the vastness of the crowds. And the second thing is, I don't know what the military, and this follows what Jim is saying, thinks that it's getting. It had a pretty pliable semi-democratic regime before. I've heard that some people think that the regime is trying to cozy up to China, but the demonstrations have had a strongly anti-China element to them. And of course, it's going to weaken the economy of Myanmar. People are going to suffer a great deal more as a result of it. So it's hard for me to make any sense of why the military would have done this at this stage.
Mm-hmm. And that opposition leader, distracting.
Aung
San
Suu
Kyi. Yes.
It just slipped my mind for a moment. Thank you.
Well, I think because of my earlier comment, maybe we're both having senior moments here, Jim. Let me ask you about this in the final 5 minutes of the program. This is from the New York Times. I'll just read some of the passages. Interesting here, as the coronavirus pandemic may affect our world and moving around in our world, the New York Times headline, "Vaccine Passports, COVID's Next Political Flashpoint." Let me quote from the article. The subject of the debate, vaccine passports, government-issued cards for smartphone badges stating that the bearer has been inoculated against the coronavirus. So some versions of the documentation might permit bearers to travel internationally. Others would allow entry to vaccinated-only spaces, gyms, concert venues, and restaurants. While such passports are still hypothetical in most places, according to this article, Israel became the first to roll out its own last week, capitalizing on its high vaccination rate. Several European countries are considering following, and President Biden, according to this article, has asked federal agencies to explore options. Wayne, where do you think this is headed? I guess when you think about it, it's not hard to imagine vaccine passports becoming, a routine part of travel documentation?
Right, but I think the word passport is dangerous. I could see where you would want medical clearance in terms of passport, but the term passport has such a broad meaning, and there are so many inequalities created by COVID that it, sort of adding the term COVID passport obviously favors the rich, well-to-do, and educated who are likely to have those passports mm-hmm. over the poor people who have not been vaccinated. And so it just aggravates the inequalities that are already there. So I think the term passport is a very bad word to use.
A vaccine passport. Yeah, the inequities in the distribution of the vaccine. Such a story in the past few weeks. Jim, your view here.
Yeah, I think the... Wayne's really right there about having it, you know, as a vaccine passport. I do think that, you know, this whole effort will be yet another, and I'm not sure we really need very much more of this, another political polarizer within yes. the country and within the international arena here. You know, there's so much division at the present time and so sharply divided lines that going in this direction makes it you know, just sort of reinforces some of the other divisions that we already have. I do see, though, I think, as I was thinking about this, I would be surprised, actually stunned, if airlines did not require some kind of documentation on vaccination here. Because, in fact, you know, airline business is so dependent, it seems to me, on certain that the travelers that they have in this kind of confined space, if there's not transmittal, because it could be really a source of great spread. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are some of these industries that decide as a part of their operation and what they need to get done might incorporate this requirement. But as a universal sentiment, wow. Certainly, it would be tough to get it passed in the U.S. Congress, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes left. Perhaps we'll dodge over to France here. This was an interesting headline, the former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, was accused of trying to obtain confidential information from a judge by offering him help land a job. He received a sentence of at least 1 year. Former French president to land in jail. He said he will be appealing this. Wayne, this is interesting. Wouldn't you say?
I think it's very interesting. I think the principal effect of this, though, is sort of giving the political class in France a black eye. There have been a number of convictions of other leaders in recent years. And one of the things that we're trying to do in democracies in general is build trust in democracy. And obviously the conviction of a former president is not going to help legitimate or strengthen democracy in France. It's not directly tied to President Macron, but it weakens the system to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Jim, we have less than a minute. Your observations here?
Well, what I think it also do, just to add to what Wayne said, Sarkozy was trying to be resurrect himself as the leader of the conservatives, and it probably has a dampening effect upon the ability of the conservatives in France to really regain the presidency, although Macron has certainly moved in that direction, and maybe can seize some of that territory. So I think there's probably a domestic political dimension aside from the larger effect that it has on democracy. And you know, a latest kind of survey The Economist does about democracy around the world, and Freedom House the same way. Democracy generally has been under siege, and one of the real reasons is corruption of officials.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Always wonderful to have you, both of you, Jim and Wayne, team up to look at some hot spots, some developments in international relations across around the globe. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ben.
And also Jim.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Matt Alvarez, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.